peacemaking is not always peaceful. Peacemaking, done well, is rarely peaceful. If we understand, as we heard in our reading this morning, that peace is more than simply an absence of active physical violence, but must include instead a state of justice and equity, then we can say that a lack of peace is a presence of violence in a similar fashion. Without peace, there is inequity, oppression, and injustice. To achieve peace, there must be equity, freedom, and justice. Now, achieving equity, freedom, and justice has never been a peaceful process. Achieving the Voting Rights Act of 1969 was a messy, violent business. Integrating schools was a process fraught with bad behavior and much nastiness. Defeating Jim Crow segregation took a lot of violence. Saying that a process is violent does not mean that all sides engage in violent behavior. It is to say that the process of dismantling systems of injustice is a violent process. Tearing down systems of oppression and privilege is disruptive to those systems and often perceived as and results in violence. And just as nonviolent resistance is not armed rebellion, the loss of privilege is not oppression. And yet the two are often conflated. Certainly those who opposed the civil rights movement of the 1960s saw the marches and sit-ins as subversive attempts to overthrow the American system of law and order. They were right. Those small acts, sitting at a lunch counter and not fighting back when attacked, or boycotting a bus system, those acts disrupted the status quo and caused great discomfort. Those acts did violence to a system. And that system was unjust. So we're pretty okay with that kind of violence. We're also okay because we can look back at them through the rosy lenses of history. We like to look back with nostalgia at the clear black and white news images of police violence, fire hoses turned on children, white mobs treating people of color in terrible ways. I spent some time this week reading Mark Morrison Reed's Selma Awakening, which chronicles the involvement of Unitarian Universalists in Dr. King's famous march from Selma to Montgomery more than a half century ago. Unitarian Universalists showed up in numbers that we can look back on with pride, but there is a more complex backstory that paints a fuller, more nuanced picture. Unitarians and Universalists, both before and after the 1961 merger of the two, have long troubled histories of race relations. Not unlike the complex Henry David Thoreau, the narrative we tell today is somewhat different than the lived reality of those years. Not every UU congregation or minister favored Dr. King's activities in the work for justice. Many favored a more measured approach, using the legal system of courts and legislatures and Congress to achieve change. Mark Morrison Reed recounts a time in the days leading up to the march from Selma to Montgomery. Unitarian Universalist minister James Reeb had been killed and was being memorialized around the country. Morrison Reed writes, "In Memphis, Tennessee, the local branch of the NAACP organized a march to honor Reeb on Sunday, March 14th. There, Father Joseph Leppert offered a moving tribute. James Madison Barr III, the minister of the Unitarian Church of Memphis, boycotted the march. He explained why that Sunday morning in his sermon, saying that King shared in the guilt for Reeb's death, along with the assailants. I will not join hands with those who help stir the cauldron of hatred and violence, he said. Let us not confuse tolerance and decency with misplaced loyalty. Let us not unwittingly help destroy the very supports necessary to keep us a free people. Respect for the courts of our land. Furthermore, he refused to participate in the march because Memphis, as he said, had done excellently in race relations, and such demonstrations hardened the feelings of bigots." Back in the 1960s, discrimination and abuse were clear-cut and obvious. Black people were not permitted to register to vote or cast ballots. Signs marked where they could and could not go. White police officers routinely beat black people, arrested them on bogus charges, harassed and terrorized communities of color, and were by all measures pretty upfront about their discriminatory ways. To resist those unjust laws and that unjust system by breaking the law was the morally right thing to do, Dr. King told us in his letter from a Birmingham jail. He wrote, "I must make two honest confessions of you, my Christian and Jewish brothers. First, I must confess over the past few years I have been gravely disappointed with the white moderate. I have almost reached the regrettable conclusion that the Negro's great stumbling block in his stride toward freedom is not the White Citizens Council or the Ku Klux Klanner, but the white moderate, who is more devoted to order than to justice, who prefers a negative peace, which is the absence of tension, to a positive peace, which is the presence of justice, who constantly says, 'I agree with you in the goal you seek, but I cannot agree with your methods of direct action,' who paternalistically believes he can set the timetable for another man's freedom, who lives by a mystical concept of time, and who constantly advises the Negro to wait for a more convenient season. Shallow understanding from people of goodwill is more frustrating than absolute misunderstanding from people of ill will. Lukewarm acceptance is much more bewildering than outright rejection." Dr. King. Back in the 1960s, lynchings were viewed as a common part of a system of institutional terror used to control people of color. What might be more accurate, though, is to say that the threat and memory of lynchings were a very significant part of the system of terror. The fear of lynching, the threat of that violence, was enough to strike fear in the heart of any African American in the country. Excluding incidents of mass killings, like the 1921 Tulsa race riot, which killed some 300 members of an affluent middle-class black neighborhood, and the 1917 riots in East St. Louis that killed somewhere between 40 and 200 African Americans, who were not counted because, first, they didn't count, and second, their bodies were thrown into the Mississippi and never recovered. Aside from major incidents like that, there were fewer documented cases of individual lynchings of black people between 1930 and 1968 than there were black people killed by police in America this year. You heard that right. More black people have been killed in America so far this year, 180 so far, of 730 in total killed by police. More black people have been killed by police in America than were killed by lynchings in the four decades before the Voting Rights Act. 159 people were killed by recorded lynchings. And lest you think I get my figures from some radical conspiracy theorist website, the lynching numbers are taken from the archives at the Tuskegee Institute. And the breakdown of police killings in America comes from the British news outlet, The Guardian. At what point do we realize that we can no longer say, that was then and this is now? It's different now. It's not different now. What has happened is that America has replaced freelance mob rule and Sunday picnic style lynchings with the organized, implicitly authorized, extrajudicial killing of black men done by armed agents of the state. I'll say that again. America has replaced freelance mob rule lynchings with organized, authorized, extrajudicial killing of black men done by armed police agents of the state. Because that killing is done by police officers does not make it any more acceptable than the old style of lynching. Indeed, it makes it ever more morally repugnant. It makes it easier for polite society to ignore. It makes it easier for us, and when I say us, I mean people who are white, to say, well, if that person hadn't been there or done that or stolen that cigar, they might still be alive. That kind of victim blaming is like telling a woman that if she hadn't been at that party or drunk that much or worn that skirt, she would not have been assaulted. It is a complete perversion of justice and compassion and responsibility. It puts the focus on the victim and not the assailant. We need to flip that approach and look at the rapist and ask those hard questions. We need to look at the police officer and ask how and why they came to shoot an unarmed man named Philando Castile, who was sitting in an automobile with his fiance and 4-year-old daughter. We also need to recognize that 30 years ago, America consented to living with a police culture that permits armed attack on black people that was evident in the MOVE bombing in Philadelphia in 1985. Now, MOVE was a poorly organized band of black separatist urban homesteaders that was, by all accounts, a very large nuisance to their neighbors. They often conflicted with the neighbors and with police, and in May of 1985, police dropped two incendiary devices, two firebombs, onto the roof of the group's row house, and then ordered firefighters to let it burn with people inside. When it was all over, a city block with 65 homes was leveled, and 11 people were dead, including 5 children. While it is largely a forgotten incident today, it marked a turning point in the American public mind of just what America would tolerate in police brutality against African American people. Firebombs that killed children and burned city blocks were acceptable policing strategies. Sure, there was some media outcry at the time, but one look at our highly militarized modern police forces will tell you the truth of that claim. Police can move as armies against the peoples they are sworn to serve and protect. And when we do not protest, our silence sends a loud message of assent and complicity. Systems of power remain in power until they are challenged and dismantled. Anyone who has read a single Psychology Today article on systems theory knows that the primary job of a system is to preserve and protect that system, and that people and pieces within the system will move around to fill gaps as they occur. To dismantle institutional racism, to dismantle white supremacist culture, to dismantle rape culture takes an enormous effort and often involves violence. The system of oppression from which all people with white skin privilege benefit has not gone away. It has not even significantly changed. It might wear the clothes of the 21st century instead of a white hood, but the system is the same. It does the same job. It teaches children in kindergarten that black kids get suspended and white kids get time out. It teaches all children that the color of their skin plays a larger role in the shape of their future than the grades they get in school. It teaches kids that this is the way it is, and if you buck the system, you get punished. Gone are those imagined glory days of civil resistance. Gone into that nostalgic haze where World War II was the last good war. Now everything seems so much more complicated. While black people technically have the right to vote, people who have criminal records that include felonies cannot vote in most states. So repeat arrests for nonviolent drug offenses escalate into felony charges and convictions. Drug laws are enforced disproportionately among communities of color, resulting in a far higher percentage of black people, predominantly black men, who are forever disenfranchised from the democratic process. School systems that disproportionately suspend children of color and arrest children of color feed directly into the privatized for-profit prison system where corporations make profits off the labor of prisoners. The plantation has been reconfigured to fit our modern form of capitalist exploitation. Black men are still wearing chains and working in the fields for the profit of the white master. In the 19th century, people believed African Americans deserved no better than their servitude. Today, people believe African Americans are morally inferior and thus deserve to be in prison at rates that outstrip any other demographic the Census Bureau cares to track. Police arresting people on trumped-up charges continues. This week, protester Elizabeth Vega was in court in St. Louis, charged with assault for wiping pepper spray on the uniform of the St. Louis Police Chief Sam Dodson. She said he walked into her hand that she'd been using to wipe the pepper spray off her face. He said she was shouting profanity and attacking him. The court believed the police and found Vega guilty of assault. She will be sentenced later this month and faces the possibility of 6 months in jail. In Flint, Michigan, the population is made up of more than 56% African American residents. Non-Hispanic whites make up just 35% of the population, down from twice that number in 1970. City and state officials deliberately switched the municipal water supply to a contaminated source, poisoning a city of almost 100,000 people in order to save money and balance the state budget. The lead levels in the poisoned water are high enough to permanently damage the developing brains of a generation of Flint children. That lead remains in the aging pipes of the water system and cannot be removed. The whole system will have to be dismantled, torn up from the pumping facility to the filter in the kitchen sinks all over town, in order to eradicate the lead that is still harming the people who live there. Lead is absorbed through the skin. They're bathing their children in water with lead. The times we live in are every bit as urgent as the 1960s. There is a profound injustice in our nation, and we must ask ourselves, how much of the devil's peace are we willing to let go of in order to achieve the real uncomfortable peace that comes with justice and freedom and compassion that we espouse in our principles? This month's theme is action. What would Dr. King ask of us today? What could he honestly accuse us of? Are we the silent, uninvolved white moderates he wrote about from his Birmingham cell? What would we like a historian like Mark Morrison Reed to say about us and our UU racial justice efforts a generation from now? In our reading today, we heard, peacemaking doesn't mean passivity. It is the act of interrupting injustice without mirroring injustice, the act of disarming evil without destroying the evildoer, the act of finding a third way that is neither fight or flight, but the careful, arduous pursuit of reconciliation and justice. It is about a revolution of love that is big enough to set both the oppressed and the oppressors free. That is my prayer. May we engage in a revolution of love big enough to set both oppressors and the oppressed free. May it be so. Amen.